This is the current federal tax developments for the week of September the 3rd, 2019. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we've got a few things happening. We're going to look first at the case of a taxpayer whose business the tax court decided didn't really exist, or at least hadn't gotten started, because she was running a horse business without a horse. That was a little bit of a problem. We have a case, the first time the tax courts had to look at this, as to what happens if you gift an interest in a partnership when you received a debt finance distribution. Does the recipient of the gift have to continue to report that interest in the same way the donor did? We're going to talk about a case of a taxpayer who received a private lead ruling allowing her to treat an IRA as her own, even though initially when her husband had died, it had been left to the children. That was redone with the court. It transferred to her. The IRS said we're fine with that. We have another case. We had this a couple of years ago where in that case, a religious organization tried to get a coffee house to get a 501c3 exemption. Now we have a non-religious organization trying, and just as they did a few years ago, it doesn't work. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about the case of a taxpayer who got into a bit of a mess because their tax returns had been sent to their last known address, or I should say, their tax returns had been sent to the preparer's address. That's what they'd used on the returns. They were also under exam. They changed preparers, and push comes to shove, a notice of deficiency went out that never got to the taxpayers, and now we're going to get into a question of, was the notice actually sent to their last known address? These are all key issues that we have coming up in this week's developments. Now, if you've been on the website, you've probably seen a couple of other developments that I posted on Friday. We were already pretty full for this week, so the other developments, which will include the new instructions for the Form 8995 draft instructions, we'll cover that in more detail next week because we're already pretty full this week. And I figure since we have a short week coming in terms of developments, probably it'll be easier to cover this stuff next week and cover it in the depth that needs to be covered. Wanted to announce one thing that's now gone live. We are doing Kaplan, the state societies, and CalCPA are working to do some online rebroadcast of sessions we have done previously. A session is coming up, and if you're aware as this works, generally this qualifies as live CPE because there's going to be a live person to ask questions of. Anybody who's been in that sort of thing before knows you have a little chat box, goes back and forth. The first one of these rebroadcasts will be a rebroadcast of a session that I did in Albuquerque back in August, and it'll be the advanced partnership issues, including the partnership audit rules. This shows up both on CalCPA's site, but also because a lot of state societies use the CalCPA broadcast, you know, and offer them directly to their members. You can check your own state society website. It actually starts at two different times that day, 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. Pacific time. A lot of state societies will choose the most appropriate one to put in their catalog. But again, that's coming up on October the 16th. Hey, day after all the due dates, right? You want to get right back into tax updates. So we'll be talking about that day. So if you want to sign up, check your state society's location. If you're in Cal, the one thing I'll point out is these rebroadcasts are being started by CalCPA a half hour earlier than the normal broadcast. So be aware that instead of 8:30 a.m. Pacific, these will start at 8. Instead of 6:30 a.m. for the early version, they'll start at 6. One of those little issues. So let's go ahead and take a look now at our first development for this week. This is the case of McMillan versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2019-108. And this case deals with a taxpayer who had been running a horse business. And by the way, this taxpayer is kind of an interesting personality anyway. You'll discover she was in the midst of suing her homeowners association. She'd been examined by the IRS multiple times and doesn't understand why. I think if you read the case, you'll understand why. All kinds of issues involved with her in this case, but the particular issue we're worried about here is her business. And she claimed to be, and she had for a long time been involved with horses, and she claimed to have a horse breeding and horse showing business. Now, the only problem with that was, for the year under exam, the horse that she had been using in her business for years, you know, the last horse had died 2 years earlier, never been replaced. She's still claiming deductions on her returns related to horse breeding and horse showing business. problem, as you may guess, for the tax court was, you know, with no horse, can you really have a horse showing or horse breeding business? And the problem they came into was the tax court decided that essentially this was like a series of other cases where the taxpayer lacked the significant thing they needed for the trader business. Merely thinking about, considering, getting ready to enter a trader business is not yet a trader business. So he talked about a case of Heinbockel, which was a taxpayer who claimed they were running a vineyard, but he hadn't planted any grapevines yet. We had McKelvey, which is a taxpayer who bought land for a tree farm, but didn't yet have any trees. And we had the case of Christian, which was a taxpayer who may have issued stocks, signed contracts, and buying components, but hadn't started actual manufacturing. In all three of those cases, the tax court held that, you know, the business hadn't started yet. You can't claim a deduction for trade or business expense if the business had not started. Now, she might have been in a business in the past, but certainly after the horse died, at the very best, she was taking time off and maybe considering getting back into the trader business. That's the best you could hope for. So in the pre-opening stage, you can't get a deduction. And by the way, the court did not rule that she actually was getting ready for this. They just noted this had happened. But if she has any chance at these deductions, they would have to be under Section 195. And that would only allow her deduction when, in fact, she actually started operating the business. So remember, we defer those. If she has up to $5,000 of expenses, we could expense those immediately upon starting the business. If it's, you know, above $5,000 and below $55,000, we have to amortize. Above $5,000, I should say, and less than $50,000, we have to amortize the amount in excess of $5,000 over 180 months. If it is, in fact, over $50,000, we lose the expensing dollar for dollar. So at $55,000, we have to amortize everything over 180 months. But, you know, she hadn't yet started the business, so none of that would be ready to go. Basic rule, as the court came down, essentially was, if you're going to have a horse business, you really kind of need to have a horse that you're doing something with, and she didn't. Next up, this case, Lipnick versus Commissioner 153 TC number 1, which was decided on August the 28th of 2019. As you may note from the citation, this is a reported tax court case. As a reported tax court case, this is looking at something that, kind of interestingly, the court had never had to actually decide before. This was a case of a taxpayer. Okay, well, the taxpayer's father is actually where we start this story. Taxpayer's father had owned an interest in a partnership. That partnership had borrowed money and then made a distribution to its partners from that borrowing. That particular ruling under Notice 8935 and under Regulation 1.163-8T governed that for DAD. 8935 says if you have a debt finance distribution from a partnership or an S corporation, that distribution, that interest, you know, we follow the distribution, and the partner or shareholder can claim a deduction on that interest, even though it's paid by the partnership, only to the extent they can trace the proceeds to something that would give rise to a deductible trader interest expense. So, for instance, if Dad took the money and then used that money to buy equipment for his operating trader business, it'd be a trader business deduction. If Dad, as he did, took that money and put it into investment assets, it's investment interest. If Dad takes that money and buys a boat, then it's non-deductible personal interest. Okay. Well, Dad, in this case, as we said, took that money, put it into investment assets, and he'd been reporting the income, I should say the interest, as investment interest. So it would come out on the K-1 as debt finance distribution interest. Dad would say, I use that for investment assets, so it's investment interest, and he'd report his investment interest. But then what happens next is, you know, so we traced it to the investments, no problem. The next thing Dad did was he gifted a portion of his interest, so now we're going to follow the gifted interest, to his son. The partnership is going to continue to report that debt finance distribution interest on the K-1 as a separately stated item because, again, it's not deductible at the partnership level. It's going to have to be determined at the individual partner level. But now here comes the rub. Of course, son never actually got the debt finance distribution. So Sund can't actually trace that anywhere, at least not directly. So, you know, the issue became, what's the proper way to report that? The IRS claimed that, wait, Sun needed to step into the shoes of Dad. So since it was investment interest on Dad's return, it should be investment interest expense on Sun's return. Now, nice for the IRS, turns out Sun had no real investment income. So almost all of the interest was being held or be non-deductible and be carried forward under the investment interest rules. The taxpayer disagreed with that. And in the end, so did the tax court. What the tax court determined, what the taxpayer was arguing was, that this debt really was taken over by the son in an acquisition of an interest. So essentially, he used it to acquire his interest. Because although the interest was gifted, what ended up happening was that he had to indirectly assume that debt in order to take over the partnership interest. And under Regulation 1.163-8T, essentially, if you assume a debt in acquiring an asset, then effectively the debt traces to the asset. The tax court said, gang, this is really what happened here. They noted first that it became a debt assumption under Regulation 1.163-8TC3II. Okay, always love those long citations. We've got that. So, Dad, kid is assumed the note, assumed the liability. And then they said, and then we look to notice 8935 again, because 8935 covered a lot of special cases. And it says, if I borrow money and use that to acquire a pass-through entity, then I look through into the pass-through entity and assign that to acquire the assets of the entity. And then we look to what those assets are used in. And obviously, this partnership conducted a trade or business. So Sun treated this as trade or business interest for that purpose, which would be an unreimbursed partner expense, UPE, deduction on Schedule E. This is an interesting case for a couple of reasons. First, it is the first time I've actually seen this. And again, I kind of understand because it's not going to come up an awful lot, but it will come up. The other interesting aside that may be a little troubling is that the court relied to some extent, and again, it's not clear how much of reliance they put on this, but they did. They looked at the debt rules under 751 for a partnership and said, well, the debt's deemed assumed, right? It's deemed to be part of the sales price when Dad got rid of it. Dad got rid of or was relieved of that much. Son acquired that much. And he got allocated that debt by the partnership, so it's part of his basis. And they're saying, well, that's why. Obviously, he picks it up. That does raise a question if you have, now I realize normally we won't have this because there are lots of reasons why this is not a real smart idea in an S-corp. But if it's an S-corp where the debt does not get allocated like that, there may be a question, or the IRS could argue that this result is not proper for an S-corporation. Now then it would get a lot more interesting to say, what is it? And if step in the shoes doesn't work, and I think that part of the logic makes sense of the decision, you know, Sun did not get the distribution. The danger is the IRS could argue, well, by default under 163, interest is personal unless you can trace it to something that's not. So we'd have a little concern there. The reason why it's not so good for S's, as I said, is because, you know, we don't get liabilities allocated back to us in basis. So what will happen too often in that case, if there was a debt finance distribution, is you would end up with a distribution in excess of the partner's outside basis. When could it arise in an S-corp? I suppose if you had an S-corp that had appreciated assets, like a building, let's not even ask how the building got in there, but we have a building in there, and Dad dies, son inherits it, son gets a step up in basis, then there might be a way that you'd say, okay, I can have a debt finance distribution because we could borrow out the equity and distribute that to son to use up some of the basis, allow son to take advantage of it, assuming son did not want to liquidate the S-corp. You know, we have that inside-outside basis problem, all kinds of weird things, but at least in theory, that we may not know how S-corps rule, but we do now know clearly how the tax court believes if you have a partnership with debt finance distribution, how that's going to be treated under the law. Next up, we have a private letter ruling a taxpayer got, private letter ruling 2019-34006, on August the 23rd. This involves the case of, and by the way, the next week we got a similar ruling that did not involve the children being the beneficiary. So the IRS is accepting these, so that's interesting to know, because this does provide a method, albeit a not cheap method because you have to pay for a private letter ruling, but potentially to fix an IRA that's left to the wrong beneficiary and the surviving spouse wants to convert it, treat it as their own. And there's lots of advantages, and under the Secure Act, it may be the only way to stretch it. So there's a couple of advantages to it, so it's interesting the IRS is granting these. Husband had an IRA account. Husband passes away. Husband's IRAs indicated that basically his beneficiaries would be their children, not his spouse. Okay? We don't know the reason why, how that worked, how dad got the kids on there, why the kids were on there instead of mom. You know, why mom wasn't the initial beneficiary and kids were the successor. We have no idea, but in any event, they've decided that, in essence, it really should go to mom so mom can roll it over, treat it as her own. Remember, if it goes to the kids, it'd be an inherited IRA. They could stretch out over their life, but obviously it goes to the kids. If it's mom's inherited IRA, basically it was not mom's IRA, then even then we got a problem because at best she can stretch it over her life expectancy. If it is her inherited IRA, then she can actually treat it as her own and effectively get to assign this deemed 10-year younger beneficiary in computing her life expectancy and recompute her life expectancy each year. And again, you know, and we delay distributions till age 70 and a half. You know, we have all of those rules in play for mom. There's lots of reasons why it may be way more beneficial for mom to treat it as her own. Well, in this case, they went to court. The court revised the beneficiary designation retroactively and made it that it went to mom. And as we said, the key issue is how we treat the IRA. Was it inherited in this case, or can the spouse treat it as her own? In this case, the IRA was ruled that it could be treated as passing directly to the spouse. The IRS said this was fine. In this case, it's not an inherited IRA. As I say, the next week, the IRS issued another private letter ruling that said the same thing in the context of an IRA that was left to a trust. What this all tells us is that the IRS is not going to balk, as you might think they would, at these revisions being done by going to court. I suspect the real reason why they don't balk is because the other parties, even if those were minor children, you know, they're supposed to be represented, and probably the court would require some separate representation because mom would have a conflict of interest in this case. And if they're adult children, they can defend themselves. And presumably, as long as the other parties are properly represented with, you know, and they have conflicting interests, they have interests that are not the same as mom, the court's okay with that. You know, the IRS is okay. They might not be okay if it was a situation where clearly the same person controlled everything. But then you get to the point of saying, well, this wasn't really left to mom in the first place. And so shouldn't the surviving spouse get it? But it does suggest that as long as the money's worth it, because remember, to get a private letter ruling, it's going to cost you, even if you're on the lower end of the scale and get reduced numbers, it's still going to cost a couple of $1,000 and very likely multiple thousands, over 10,000, just to get the ruling request in, and then there'll be the professional time to get it through. This is not something you do with a $5,000 IRA. You know, even though theoretically you could get this ruling, you'd use up more money than's in the IRA to get it. So, but if you have a large IRA, let's say it's got $500,000, $1 million in it, now we got big enough numbers to make it worthwhile to consider going after this ruling request. Next up, another private letter ruling request, 2019-34008. This is a ruling, I just want to bring this up because a couple of years ago we had almost the identical fact situation, but in the context of a religious organization trying to set up a coffee house. In this case, we have a taxpayer, we have an organization. They want to get 501c3 status from the IRS. 501c3 charities can receive contributions that are fully deductible. It's a tax-exempt organization. You know, it's got all kinds of advantages why they'd like to be a C3. Now, obviously, a coffee house itself, you know, when I stopped at Starbucks this morning, they're definitely in the business of selling coffee, and they're not a not-for-profit organization. And, you know, no matter if I just wanted to throw $20 on the counter for no reason, I wouldn't get a charitable contribution. So how do we make this coffee house into a charitable organization? At least, what was their theory of the case? Their theory is not going to hold up, but what was their theory? Very much like the church. They argued that, you know, while they were serving coffee and all the standard stuff, you get your cappuccinos, your lattes, you know, you can get your pastries, your breakfast sandwiches type things, all of those things there at the coffee house. They were going to do charitable work. They were going to, you know, help and assist in fundraising for local organizations. Presumably, when you came in the coffee house, you know, there'd be fundraising options to give money to all the worthy charities. It was a community launch point for not-for-profit organizations. They could use the facilities to get together. It also was going to be open to allow for local artists and musicians to show their work or showcase their work in the coffee house to launch them out. They're saying so it supported the arts. They're saying, look at all these really good things we're doing. But the problem is, just doing all those good things does not convert a commercial operation into a charitable one. The IRS did note that back in 1968, Revenue Ruling 6872, they did have a nonprofit organization that had a facility to bring together young people of college age with church leaders, educators, businessmen, and they did do it through the operation of a coffee house type operation, but there the beverages and everything were provided at a nominal cost. In this particular situation, they were going to charge just like what I paid today at Starbucks. Their prices were set like that. They had a menu that looked like that. If you walked in there and you didn't care about charity at all, you know, you basically could just buy your coffee, buy your pastry, leave. In essence, it's operating just like a standard commercial coffee house. It's operating basically like the Starbucks I was in this morning. And because of that, the primary operation is running a coffee house. It's not operated principally for exempt purposes, and because of that, it cannot be a 501c3. This is not just the case of a 501c3 that would have unrelated business income. In this case, the business is so significant, it dwarfs the whole, you know, exempt organization purposes. It's a nice thing they're doing that they'd offer all these things, these organizations, but it's not going to make them an exempt organization. Finally, we're going to consider the case of Chapman versus Commissioner, Tax Credit Memorandum Decision 2019-110, issued on August the 29th. Now, you may have read about this case because this case actually involves Dwayne Chapman and his recently deceased wife, Alice Smith. And you probably read about them this summer, about her fight with cancer, unsuccessful, passed away. It was just a few weeks ago that this happened. And where they come from, in case you weren't following their TV careers, 8 seasons they had of the show Dog the Bounty Hunter, get that right, on A&E, and 3 seasons of Dog and Beth on the Hunt on CMT. So they had been on TV back in the early 2000s, in early parts of this decade with their show. Their show dealt with bounty hunting and did a lot with their experiences in Hawaii and Colorado. Now, the problem occurs because in the years in question, they had used 2 different CPAs to prepare their returns. The CPAs were located in Los Angeles. Now, as you might guess from the show, they primarily lived in Colorado and Hawaii. But obviously, we suspect with all the TV work they did, entertainment work they did, you know, having a CPA in the Southern California area handle your tax issues, there's specialties there, there's some issues. So they're in the entertainment industry. I kind of understand why they had that happen. In both cases, for both years, they had the CPA use the CPA's address as the mailing address on the tax return. So it would list their name, their ID numbers, and then the CPA's address. Now, what happened down the case was the taxpayers used 1 CPA, and he was representing them in the exam. At some point after the return was filed for 2010, they apparently changed and went to use a different CPA who had worked for the first one, but was now, had now gotten a CPA license, was working on his own, and he had apparently been working with them at the first CPA firm. The first CPA files a notice that he's withdrawing his power of attorney. Also, somebody at that point contacts the IRS, and we don't have in the record exactly who, but they were authorized, and gave the IRS a new address, which was the second CPA's address. Okay. Now, in all this time, and eventually they would file their 2011 tax return using that second CPA's address. That return would be filed in October of 2012. The exam was kind of finishing up. And by the way, the new CPA had told the appellate agent, because the case was at appeals, he had told the appellate, officer, the appeals officer, that he would be sending in a power of attorney sometime after the end of August to take over for them. That never actually came through. Okay, so the other CPA, the new CPA, never had a power of attorney on file. The old CPA's power had been withdrawn. And that's important because obviously copies of notices that go to the power of attorney holder, there is no POA holder, there's no copy going anywhere at this point. So we're kind of in a different problem. Now the IRS basically recorded those changes to the CPA's address, right? We had the phone call come in, right? All those things happened, right? And essentially the IRS then issues this note. So it comes up, they're ready to issue the notice of deficiency. The appellate officer knew about the fact that they had addresses and knew that their current business was in Hawaii. Okay, so he asked somebody in the IRS to verify the address that the notice of deficiency should go to because they were getting ready, whatever they ruled, there'd be a notice and it had to go somewhere. The person in the IRS researched the addresses. Now, just before this notice is issued, the taxpayer filed that 2011 return with an address in Los Angeles. Okay, no return ever used either their residence in Hawaii or their business in Hawaii. That was never on a return. There was never any document that stated that going to the conferee. Obviously, the appellate officer was aware of the location, but never had there actually been anything suggesting that their contact address was going to be that address for tax purposes. And they just filed a tax return, which had the new address. Well, the IRS employee looking for addresses noted the appellate officer, the appeals officer, about the fact he'd found two addresses in Los Angeles. He'd also found an address in Colorado and an address in Hawaii, but those appeared to be old. So the notice of deficiency was actually issued then shortly thereafter, and it went to the two addresses. The address of the first CPA, right, the one who had resigned in Los Angeles, and a second notice went to the CPA who was now preparing the returns, the one had the address on the current return. Now, the taxpayer claims they never, ever, ever got either one of those they never got the notice of deficiency. And in fact, they didn't file their tax court petition until over 500 days after the notice was issued. Most likely, eventually, notices caught up with them, looking for the money. And so, they now file their petition. They claim it was never delivered. It was not sent to the last known address. The tax court wasn't so sure about that. The tax court said, look, here's a problem we've got. The returns only have the addresses, the two addresses where this was sent to. The only other direct contact we had to update an address came, after the old CPA resigned, and it told you to use this address of the new CPA. Nowhere did we ever get any sort of notice using, to use this Hawaii business address as your address or your Hawaii residential address. The court also said at trial during this case, when you were filing, you kept changing whether it was your home address or the business address was the address they should have sent it to. And, you've claimed, and apparently at trial, you end up claiming they should have sent to both. The court said, this doesn't work. They're saying the IRS is given the rule under law if they send to the last known address. The court notes that first thing singular. They're saying the taxpayer couldn't even figure out which one of their Hawaii addresses was what they were claiming was the last known address. They're saying the IRS had an address on the return. They had a contact from the taxpayer saying it should go to that address. They're saying basically that address of the preparer, the new preparer, became their last known address. Or if you ignored that phone call, then it would have been the address of the old CPA. And they said they went to both of those. They said the IRS is not required to figure out if anybody anywhere in the agency ever has been told anything that might suggest their other addresses, or they have to send it to every address they've ever thought might be connected with the taxpayer. They said that's simply not a burden that the IRS has to bear. The IRS properly sent it to your last known address. Now, you're telling us you didn't get it. The CPA, whose address was listed, said he didn't get it. Well, we don't really care. It was certified mail. We actually had U.S. Postal Service evidence of delivery where they said they delivered it. It's like, you know, tough luck. They sent it to the last known address. A couple of takeaways from this. First, I understand that it's easier to have the taxpayer's address listed as the CPA's because in theory, then the CPA will know about any notice. It's kind of a backdoor way of doing it without getting a power of attorney. And that's okay. But obviously, then you become responsible for anything that happens to those notices. The reality was the notice was, you know, the IRS has evidence that they sent it. They have the certified mail receipt. You know, it's kind of the reverse of the problem we have proving mailing. Yeah, now the IRS has proved mailing, and they've even got a proof of delivery internally from the Postal Service. You know, it's up to that CPA now to prove that it wasn't received. Well, that's proving the negative is impossible, pretty much. And the other problem was, because there wasn't a real power of attorney, there was never a second update sent, right? So a second version of that. He never represented them in the exam, so another copy never got sent. You know, always had send copies to this one, and you know that wasn't happening. Clearly, it's a risk whenever the CPA or tax preparer uses their own address on the return for the client. You know, you need to be careful. In this case now, you know, now the question is going to probably revert to, Now, does the client now wonder if the CPA misplaced it? You know, that's going to be the next point. It was delivered, according to the Postal Service, it was delivered. Had we known this, we could have filed a tax court petition. We could have challenged this. Now we can't. We're stuck with this assessment. Yeah, you can see how this went bad. You know, be careful here. You know, make sure last known addresses are updated. And just be really, really careful. You know, the other question was, this went on for 500 days. I realize that there's this bias of you just kind of hope that the IRS has forgotten that the statute's going to end, and I understand that point. But now you're going to realize that in court, that CPA is probably going to be asked of, well, why didn't you ask the IRS about where this was, you know, the appellate conferee, and why didn't you send in the power of attorney? You know, you claimed it would be sent in August. It didn't happen. Again, we don't know the reasons why. There may have been a falling out with the new CPAs. They may have been on to a third accountant by the time this was done. You know, we're just not sure what all the backstory is and how all this works. All we know is, you know, at the end of the day, they lost their day in court. Well, it is that time of year. We're getting here in fall. Now, again, you've got all these deadlines now, so I suspect most of you are not signing up for a whole lot of CPE over the next couple of months. You're probably going to be looking at it right at, you know, after October 15th. That's when you'll start doing things. But take a look in your state society's catalogs. We've got lots of things coming up, live sessions in a number of states. And as I said, a lot of these new, you know, recorded update, this recorded rebroadcast, we'll be doing those also. They'll be coming out during that time frame. We've got additional ones of those that'll be coming out. We'll talk about those later. But check your state societies, check your catalog, see what's offered. I'd love to see you at a live course. You know, if you can't do that, you can do the rebroadcast. But the state societies offer a lot of options. Things are still changing rapidly under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Guidance is coming. As that guidance comes out, it may very well drop on us here in the next month or so. It will drop on us maybe, you know, the IRS, I'm sure, realizes that December is coming. That's going to be another tax filing season, and obviously there's going to be pressure to get guidance out. So you want to check, sign up, find your update courses, find your key courses, and sign up for them here, again, for the period after October 15th all the way through the start of the upcoming tax season. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 3rd, 2019. Current Federal Tax Developments, again, brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education, get my name right there, and by your state societies of CPAs. We are going to be posting updates all during the week on the currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com site. You can visit us there, www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Ed Zollars. You can email me, edzollars@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, if you have any quick questions. I also follow the discussions on the Connect sites for Arizona, New Jersey, and Minnesota. So if you have any questions or issues, you post there and I see the question and I think I can help, I'll try to step in there. I also look in on Cal CPA's Tax Talk. That is open to any CPA, in essence, who's licensed anywhere in the country. So if you want to check in on the Cal CPA organization, you go to basically groups.yahoo.com/taxtalk. You ask to be let in. As long as you're a CPA or an attorney licensed in one of the states, you'll get in. And then you're able to interact there. I also spend time on the subreddit, Tax Pros, which is reddit.com/r/taxpros. That's open to any tax pro of any type who can post there. And again, it's not for individuals who are looking for personal tax advice. That stuff is taken off the board quickly. It's rather, tax professionals discussing tax pro issues, useful place to go. So take a look at any of those. As I said, we've already got stuff to discuss next week. I just don't have enough time this week to go into that as well. So we'll pick those up for next week. We should have more developments. We may see regulations come out. We know some things are in the pipeline for 451. They've been cleared by OIRA. We're waiting for the IRS to clear them. We're going to be looking at guidance on things like 163J. We need those finals to come out. We need the IRS to bring out information on other items. We're looking at a whole bunch of areas, the excess built-in loss, all those issues. The IRS is now publishing the instructions, draft instructions, so we're getting some other guidance there. Join us next week. We'll look at what happens, try to keep up and see how things are going, and we'll keep up all through this year, so join us each week here for current federal tax developments.